Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, the Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he condemned the unacceptable carnage of an attack on Syria's Idlib province, blamed on chemical weapons. Papal visit to Egypt. We look ahead to Pope Francis's upcoming visit to Egypt, with the help of the former apostolic nuncio to that country. Fickle followers. We have our final Lenten reflection that takes its inspiration from the fickleness of the crowds praising Jesus in the Palm Sunday story. Jesus's agony in art. Looking ahead to Christ's passion, we explore where we can see artwork depicting his torment in the Garden of Gethsemane. And struggling to be a good Samaritan. Father Jerry O'Collins shares with us an event from his own life that highlights how demanding is Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan. We begin our broadcast, as usual, with a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he condemned what he described as the unacceptable carnage of the attack in Syria's Idlib province. Linda Bordoni reports.
Esprimo la mia ferma deplorazione per l'inaccettabile strage.
I firmly deplore the unacceptable carnage, Pope Francis said, that took place yesterday in Idlib province, where scores of helpless people, including many children, were killed.
Tra cui tanti bambini.
And while the Pope said he is praying for the victims of that attack and for their families, he issued an urgent appeal to the consciences of those who have political responsibilities, both on a local and on an international level, to halt this tragedy and to bring relief to the population that has been sorely tried by war for far too long.
Faccio appello alla coscienza di quanti hanno responsabilità politiche.
Pope Francis also had words of encouragement for those who, notwithstanding the insecurity, are continuing in their efforts to bring help to the inhabitants of the war-torn region. And highlighting another tragedy of the past few days, the Pope said he is praying for the victims of Monday's subway bomb attack in the Russian city of St. Petersburg, which killed 14 people and injured 50 others.
Di San Pietroburgo.
He said he is close to all those who are suffering because of this dramatic event, which, he said, has caused a sense of loss and confusion to the Russian people. I'm Linda Bordoni.
Pope Francis is set to make a pastoral visit to Egypt on April the 28th and 29th, his first overseas trip of this year. His busy programme includes meetings with the Egyptian president, the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, and the Coptic Orthodox Pope of Alexandria, plus an address to the International Conference on Peace and the celebration of Mass. Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald was the former apostolic nuncio to Egypt and is one of the Church's leading experts on Islam and Christian-Muslim relations. He spoke to Philippa Hitchin about the importance of this upcoming papal visit.
Well, it is significant in that he goes to places where there are difficulties, I suppose, and we know that the situation in Egypt is always one of uncertainty with extremists who are against the institution and against Christians in a particular way. So I think that is why it is significant. It's not the first papal visit, because Pope John Paul II went before in the year 2000 and was received remarkably well, and I'm sure that Pope Francis will be received very well. What I think is significant is the relationship between Pope Francis and Pope Tawadros, because they call him a pope, the Copts. And as you may remember, the first journey that Pope Tawadros did once he had been elected as the Patriarch of Alexandria for the Coptic Orthodox was to Rome to see Pope Francis. And they got on very well. And I'm sure that this will be another moment consolidating this friendship between the two popes.
So is it more a result of these personal friendships, do you think, or can we also see this as a result of the ongoing theological dialogue?
Well, with the Coptic Orthodox, I think it is more the personal relationship than a result of the theology. The discussion on the role of the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is ongoing. And a colleague of mine, Father Franz Bauern, is engaged in these discussions together with the Oriental Orthodox, that is not only the Copts, but also the other churches that were not present at Chalcedon. This is ongoing, and they've been looking at the way the primacy has been lived. But, you know, as Pope Francis himself says, the theological dialogue is very important, but that has to be carried on by other people. He's not going to be doing that during his very short trip to Cairo.
In terms of the relationship with the Muslim world, what difference can this make, this visit to Al-Azhar?
Well, it consolidates what has gone on very recently, that the dialogue with Al-Azhar has been renewed after a time when it was cut. So the Imam came to see the Pope in Rome, and this is reciprocating this visit. I think that is one of the main motives for the Pope's journey, is to say, Imam Dr. Tayyib came to see me, I'm going to go and see him. And, you know, that is highly appreciated. The fact that the Holy Father would, you know, take the trouble of making a visit, and I'm sure he'll be well received. And again, the serious discussions will go on at other levels afterwards.
Can it make any difference, though, do you think, in the difficult relationship beyond just this friendship between these two people?
Well, there, you never know with Pope Francis. He may say something that is, you know, quite remarkable and that will help to break the ice and will help in relations and also on the other side, too. But I don't think that we expect any big change. It is a step. It's a step that is there, and it's important. You know, these are important people, and when they meet, let them say what they want together. But the very fact of meeting is, let's call it a sacrament, because it is a sign. It's not just a symbol. It is actually doing something, and it is producing something as well, which goes beyond themselves and beyond their own persons, I think.
The recent dialogue session was looking explicitly at the question of how to tackle religious fundamentalism and extremism and violence in the name of religion. And I understand that Al-Azhar has started an observatory to try and monitor more closely the extremist elements, particularly on social media. Is there, do you think, a determination within the Islamic world to really take a stronger stand against this type of extremism?
I'm sure there is, because this extremism has been condemned by the majority of Muslim leaders around the world, and they're in different places. They are trying to tackle this problem. The observatory will be very useful, I think, because of if it is looking into social media, because that is a very strong, you know, we see even in Britain that the people who are radicalized, it is usually through the internet and through the ways that they have got into, you know, sites that promote this type of radical initiatives. One thing that Al-Azhar has done is to agree with the Dominicans in Cairo, who have an institute there and a wonderful library. They have formed a group to study extremism together. So this is something ongoing too. It's not just one-sided, it is together with Christians.
So can hopefully make a difference in the longer run?
One would hope so. I think, I don't want to be pessimistic, but you always have to relativize things. I mean, even within the Christian world, we as Catholics, we look to the Pope and we say, you know, what the Pope says, that's for all the Christian world. But there are many Christians in the world who don't look up to Pope Francis in that way. you know, who don't see in him a figure of authority. The same is true for Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar has a prestigious role within the Islamic world, but it isn't followed by all the Muslims around the world. And so that has to be taken into account, I think, not to expect miracles. We pray for miracles, but we don't always expect them.
That was Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, the former Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt, speaking to Philippa Hitchin. The fickleness of Jesus' followers, who showered him with praise during his entry into Jerusalem and then abandoned him, is the inspiration for the last in our series of Lenten reflections prepared by Father Colm Kelly, chaplain for the Apostleship of the Sea, the Church's maritime agency. Taking his cue from that gospel reading for Palm Sunday, Father Kelly writes his reflection from the viewpoint of the seafarers whom he ministers to, and whose jobs entail spending many weeks away at sea.
And the crowds shouted, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." We've just been told that we should reach our final port tomorrow. I have last year's palm cross in my cabin, but it'd be good to get another one, just to remind me yet again of the unconditional love of God for all of us. The cross is also a reminder to me of the fickleness of people in the story of Holy Week. The week begins with the people shouting, praising God in his entry into Jerusalem, and ends with the same people shouting, "Crucify him." Would I have been that fickle if I had been there? I probably would. It seems that there may have been two processions entering Jerusalem for the beginning of the festival. One led by Pontius Pilate, coming on horseback, armed with a military force to maintain power and peace in the city during Passover. The second, a mixed group waving palm branches, following a man on a donkey, a man offering an alternative version of service and a different kind of peace, not one imposed by violence. What a contrast, two very different images of kingship and power. But he comes on a borrowed donkey. What kind of king is this? Someone once remarked to me that Jesus was born in a borrowed place, laid his head in a borrowed manger, and as he travelled he had no place of his own to spend the night. He borrowed a boy's loaves and fish to perform one of his great miracles. And now on Palm Sunday we hear that he comes into the city on a borrowed donkey. He ate his final meal in a borrowed room, crucified on a borrowed cross, and when he died, somebody placed his body in a borrowed tomb. He came into the world with nothing and left the world with nothing. His life was total service, not encumbered by acquiring many things. It occurs to me that I'm living a little bit like that on the ship. It's my home, but only borrowed until the next crew come along. My work clothes are borrowed from the shipping company, only to be given back to the crew member who will next replace me. And even my ship family is borrowed. Above all, I think of the loneliness of Jesus in this Holy Week. One day proclaimed Messiah, and yet as the week goes on, even his friends begin to desert him. Hearts of love turning into hearts of stone. When we enter port tomorrow, there won't be any cheering crowds. Wouldn't it be funny if there were? But we're only simple seafarers. I wish people would think of us sometime when we bring all the things that they have in their homes. Their shops would be empty without us. But no, our welcome party to the port will be local customs officials, agents, port health inspectors, cargo supervisors. But the real welcome will come later, when one or two chaplains or volunteers from the Apostleship of the Sea will visit our vessel. There will be no form filling or awkward questions. Just one or two folk committed to their work, coming to see if we're okay, to ask about our families back home, and mostly to offer themselves in service to us, offering to do all they can to help to make our stay in port a little bit more comfortable. And I'm sure they will try to help us to be a part of this holiest week in the church's year, maybe bringing us a new palm cross. And that's a real welcome. So as Lent draws to a close, I have much to reflect upon from the lessons I have learnt at sea this time. I need to be more aware of the needs of so many people, and not just the physically broken ones. I'm thinking too of people who carry hurts and rejections because people have told them they're no good or they're not worthy to have a share in all that Jesus came to offer us. My prayer this Holy Week will be for all who take up the cross as followers of Christ in service of others. Pray for the courage never to be afraid to speak up for justice. I will pray for people who are alone and feel tired and weary from all the struggles of life. Our time at sea is over. Welcome home.
And many thanks there to Father Colm Kelly for that Lenten reflection. Looking ahead to Jesus' passion, and specifically his agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, just hours before he was put to death on the cross, where can we find this scene depicted in the Vatican? Tracy McClure found out the answer by talking to art historian Liz Lev. Let's listen to her report.
Though it's one of the pivotal and certainly most tragic moments of Christ's passion, the agony in the garden has not been widely depicted in art, or at least less so than other events from his last days. Art historian Elizabeth Lev tells us where one scene of the agony is depicted here in the Vatican, and she points to more modern forms of art that have expressed it too.
There's one very small image of the agony in the garden represented by Cosimo Rosselli, one of the painters of the Sistine Chapel in the 1480s. But it's a very small window. It's actually part of the last panel on the right-hand side panels of the stories of Christ. And it's the Last Supper with three windows looking outside of the room of the Last Supper. And the first window on the left shows this agony in the garden. But
so you're actually in the room of the Last Supper and you can see through the windows and you see the agony in the garden.
You see the agony in the garden, you see the arrest, and you see the crucifixion. So you see how these stories from the moment of the Last Supper, from Holy Thursday and the Last Supper, the story telescopes into the Passion of Christ. So everything is summed up in one single panel. The Vatican Agony in the Garden, very, very small representation, is really one of the very, very few images of this sort that you will see in Rome. In this city, there's something of a dearth of agony in the garden scenes, and actually in the history of art, there are very few. There's a flurry right around the late 1400s and the early 1500s in which you get some of the finest painters, Andrea Mantegna, Giovanni Bellini, the great Venetian painters all take a stab at this image of the agony of the garden. They all represent it in the same way, and by the way, the same way that Cosimo Rosselli represents the image. Three apostles asleep in the lowest corner of the painting, the part that's closest to the viewer. Jesus raised up on a mount, generally with his back to us, so we don't really see what's going on. And in some images that derive from St. Luke, particularly Mantegna's as well as Rosselli's, in these images they have the angel that brings the chalice or some indication of the Jesus who sweat drops of blood and the angel who came to strengthen him in this struggle. But amazingly enough, the thing that I find particularly interesting about talking about this subject is that some works of art take a long time to create and iconography. So, for example, our vision of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin, which everybody's mind, you know, Mary wearing the white with the light blue, and she's standing on a serpent, and she's standing, and you've got the crown of stars around her head. This imagery that immediately will come to everyone's mind. It took 800 years to create that image. And what I found when I was thinking about this and looking through all the images, that the person who really captured the spirit of the agony of the garden was actually, it was captured in cinema. It took cinema to create the idea of the agony of the garden. And when
you'll have to explain that one, because we didn't have cinema until what, 1920?
Until 2001 is where I'm going, or 2003, and the arrival of the movie The Passion, which many people have many different issues with, but there are many things that perhaps are not the consecration of iconography. However, the agony of the garden in the garden, I do not think has ever been better depicted. It's the opening of the movie. It's drawn, the whole story of the movie is drawn and supplemented not only from the gospel, but from the visions of the blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. But this the word agony comes from the Greek agone. It is only used once in the gospel, and the word means struggle. Piazza Navona here in Rome is actually from the term agone, which are the agonistic games, the competitions that took place in the Piazza Navona when it was the stadium of Domitian. They use this term once in the gospel. They use it for Jesus's struggle in the garden and this preparation. And the way that Mel Gibson captures this heroic Christ, you know, beaten to the ground with his fear, then getting up and getting ready to face the battle, really, it opens up a whole new way of thinking about, a way of meditating on, a way of feeling close to one of the hardest aspects of Christ's passion. You know, we the physical torture we all know about, we have plenty of images of, but that emotional difficulty of knowing what's ahead. He's God. He knows what's coming. And then to have his friends all falling asleep, to have his friends left behind. So the sense of abandonment with which he goes into the ring. And I would like to just bring up that in the history of Christian art and literature, this idea that the agony of the garden presents to us, of the hero who awaits the moment of battle, the hero who's getting ready to step out into the ring, it has been picked up and created some of the greatest works of art that you and I know. For example, Michelangelo's famous David in the Academia, where it's not David in the middle of the ring, it's not David after the battle, it's David in that moment when he prepares to step out and face Goliath. It's a very interesting thing to remember in our world, that as much as Hollywood or the pop culture, or even, you know, pop music tries to deny it, a great many of our most powerful forms of imagery, they come from the Christian tradition.
Let's go back a moment to this image in the Sistine Chapel. Here we look at these three apostles who are lying with their backs to Jesus, who's there on the mount praying. And in a way, I think we Christians, we see ourselves mirrored in these three disciples who do have our backs turned to Jesus. We've left him in his moment of dire need.
All these images, more so than the Cosimo Rosselli, which of course is a papal commission, but the actual panel paintings of the Agony in the Garden are usually private commissions. They're commissioned by wealthy gentlemen, people who put them up as a kind of private devotional piece. And in that particular form of commission, that's exactly what this is about. The emphasis tends to be on the apostles, who, as a matter of fact, if you see in this image, a lot of them, or if somebody Googles them or pulls out an art book, you'll find them in these very good artists such as Mantegna and Bellini, who were experts at foreshortening, that is, making a part of the body seem close to you and part of the body seem far away from you. You'll find that the bodies of one of the apostles is usually foreshortened towards you. So it's really a link to you in looking towards the painting. So this is sort of a radical shift that takes place when these images were first commissioned, or this flurry of commissions in the late 1400s. They represent more of a meditation on our own inadequacy to be a friend to Jesus in need, our own incapacity to stay awake, to stay with him all the way through to the end. And at the same time, it does re-emphasize Christ's loneliness, because from that you can extrapolate, you can project into, you know, Jesus alone on the mountain suffering. But I think I think the Renaissance is very much a very humanocentric age, something that they're concerned a lot about the patron. The patron sees himself, the patron wants to put himself. So I think actually what makes the modern shift interesting is to put the focus back on Jesus again.
And thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
And that report was prepared by Tracy McClaw. The parable of the Good Samaritan from St. Luke's Gospel is one of Jesus' best-loved parables and has a message that is both powerful and demanding. Jesuit Father Jerry O'Collins is an Australian theologian and author who taught for many years at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He shares with us a memory from his personal life that highlights how difficult it is for us to live up to the message contained in the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Years ago, on an agreeable summer's evening in Sydney, I was walking down a suburban street with my sister and a female cousin of ours. At that time, my sister was a social worker, a cousin a nurse, and I had just been ordained a priest. As we walked along, we came across a man sitting on the footpath. His feet were dangling in the gutter, and his body gently swaying backwards and forwards. The strong smell of spirits caught us as we went by. Half an hour later, the three of us came back along the same street. Some paramedics were loading the man on board their ambulance. He was drunk all right, but he'd been sitting down because a car had hit him, broken his leg, and failed to stop. "We've just repeated the parable of the Good Samaritan," my sister commented. "Only this time, instead of a priest and a Levite passing by on the other side, it's been a case of a priest, a social worker, and a nurse passing by on the same side." How right my sister was, and how practical and demanding Jesus is in his parable of the Good Samaritan. He wants us to stop and help any neighbours in distress that we come across on the road of life. Jesus himself was totally at the service of others, of those who desperately needed him and his help. He was the Good Samaritan in person. He stopped to heal our wounds and carry us to safety. In the parable he told, the Good Samaritan put the wounded traveller up on his donkey and then walked ever so slowly, holding the man on the saddle, until they reached the inn further down the road. It was a generous and a dangerous thing to do. Bandits had struck once when they wounded and robbed the traveller. They could easily have been waiting to strike again around the next corner. And who is more vulnerable than a man holding a wounded person in the saddle and walking along ever so slowly beside a donkey? In stopping to help and heal us, Jesus did a most generous thing and a most dangerous thing, and they did come for him. This Good Samaritan stopped to wounded people and was struck down, wounded, and killed himself. Jesus paid for his real love with his own life. Yes, the parable of the Good Samaritan is a terribly demanding story. It calls on us to get involved at any time and with anyone who desperately needs our help. That parable sets the standard awfully high, but we have this comfort. Jesus himself lived out that parable to the uttermost, and he's always there to give us the strength and help we need to put his words into practice.
And that reflection came from the Australian Jesuit priest, Father Jerry O'Collins. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.